My talk today is going to be about AVL, but as I was walking down the steps here, I thought of a story told to me by a federal judge a number of years ago. And it was about Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes, who was an associate justice of the Supreme Court. And he was a very distinctive-looking fellow and also had a reputation for forgetfulness. And the story goes that he was on a train leaving Washington, and the conductor came up and said, sir, can I please have your ticket? And Holmes started searching here and there and through his case, and he couldn't find it. And at that point, the conductor said to Holmes, who he just recognized, he was in the paper a lot, he was a very interesting-looking fellow, and said, oh, don't worry, Justice Holmes, when you find the ticket, just send it to the railway company. And Holmes is supposed to have said, young man, the problem is not where is my ticket, the problem is where am I going? So the problem I'm going to talk a little bit about today is the issue of where are the police going, or where are the police? The title of my presentation, as Jim said, was Can Automobile Vehicle Locator Systems Be Used to Manage Police Presence and Reduce Crime? And I should note this is a study that I did with the Police Foundation in Washington, D.C., and as you see from here, Liz Groff and Greg Jones, Karen Mendel, and Brian Cave also worked on. I think what the key issue here is that for a generation, Larry, myself, and others have worked with the police in letting them know that where crime is very important. In this audience, the idea of hotspots would not be surprising. And indeed, the first study of hotspots policing by Larry and I was done in Minneapolis when Anthony Boza was chief. So the idea that we need to know where the crime is has been a part of policing, important part of policing for years. Indeed, in recent surveys, it seems that most police departments know that. They need to have a sense, a geographic sense, of where crime is concentrated in the city. But the problem is that we still know very little about where the police are. Now, this was something that hit me very hard a year or two ago. I've just finished a book. It's called The Criminology of Place, Street Segments on Our Understanding of the Crime Problem. It's being published by Oxford University Press. It's coming out this summer. It's the first longitudinal study of crime places, of hotspots. We tracked hotspots in Seattle, Washington over a 60-year period. We collected all sorts of data on the characteristics of those places. We divided the city up, by the way, into 25,000 street segments. And in each of those street segments, we collected all sorts of data. Indeed, even data on what we call collective efficacy, the willingness of citizens to be involved in public affairs. We had data on the percent of people on each street that actually voted in elections. We had all that data. And when I was doing this, I started analyzing that data. And I said to myself, wait a minute. I don't know where the police were. In other words, I had spots that started very hot in the early 1990s and got very cool 10 years later over time and trajectory. And I said to myself, well, maybe one of the reasons that happened was because there was a lot of police presence there. So I went to Seattle, and I spoke to the command staff, and I said, do you have any data on where your police are? And they said, no. And then they said, well, maybe we could look at the special operations. But this would turn into a gigantic mess, or difficulty, at least for us. We couldn't do it. And this study, in a sense, grows out of that interest. I wanted to get data on where the police were. Now, the interesting thing about this, of course, is, as we all know, where you are is an easy thing today. I have an iPhone in my pocket. Someone can track me everywhere I am all the time. I can push a button and know where exactly I am. And indeed, as I'll talk about in a minute, in policing, there's been a great deal more availability of such technologies. Indeed, I think Larry is using a handheld GPS with officers, right, for one of your experiments. So this is becoming very readable. But the truth is, this technology has been available to the police for many years through AVL systems, through automobile vehicle locator systems. Now, what our study tried to do at the foundation was to ask the question of whether such knowledge, if we used it, would aid police in allocating resources and preventing crime. So here are the two questions for the study. Does knowledge of where patrol resources are concentrated at the beat level allow police commanders to manage patrol resources better, and following this to reduce crime? So one question is at a sort of more macro level. Allocations in the city we studied in Dallas of police patrol are done at the beat level. That's how you decide how many elements or how many cars you're going to put in each area. But there's another important question that we've known at least since the Minneapolis hotspots experiment, which is, does knowledge about patrol resources at crime hotspots increase directed patrol at those places? And does that lead to crime control gains? So another key question was at the hotspot level. I'll just tell you that for Dallas, they weren't as interested in the hotspot level, interestingly enough. They were really interested in the beat level, the management level, as they saw it, or the larger management level of police resources. Now, AVL technology has been around for years. Most police departments have it. But the truth is that most police departments have it, but they don't use it beyond some very specific purposes. One of the major purposes is emergencies. You lose a car, in a sense. You want to know where the cops are. There's an emergency going on. You're worried about them. Well, we've used it for that purpose. However, we haven't used it to track where the cars are all the time. Now, there are a group of reasons, departments are beginning to do this. Jim Bierman is doing this in his department. Some other departments are doing it as well around the world, and here you're doing it to some degree. But the reason why people haven't done this has to do with a group of things. One, this produces an amazing amount of data. Imagine a city with hundreds of cars moving around all day long, 24 hours a day. Tracking them is very difficult. So one of the hard problems has been the technology was available, but the programs for in some way identifying exactly where those cars were all the time and utilizing that information was more difficult. Indeed, we worked with Dallas on that problem. But a more important reason, at least in the U.S., has to do with unions. The unions do not want the police department to know where the police are all the time because they're worried that if that happens, it becomes a supervisory mechanism for them, a way of watching them, and they don't want that to happen all the time. And I suspect here that might not be as large an issue. But in the States, it's a very large issue. Most departments in the U.S. that would want to start using AVL systems have to face the problem of their union saying, what is this, you're going to watch us all the time, know where we are all the time? It doesn't seem like, as I'm saying this, an irrational idea to me. In the UK perspective, is this a problem that we would know where the police are all the time as well? It is a problem as well. Okay. So, but I can't blame only the police because in this experiment, we ran into another problem, human subjects. It turns out that at least the Human Subjects Committee of the Police Foundation was not enthusiastic about the idea of us tracking where the police were all the time. They told us that if we tracked individual officers, we would have to get permission from each officer, a human subject's agreement that they knew we were tracking them and agreed to us tracking. So there are lots of problems, if you want to think about it, in terms of doing this sort of research. And I'll just note that we didn't track in our study individual officers. We tracked total amounts of patrols. I'll show you in a few minutes. So the union problem, and for us, the human subject's problem, made it harder to do this research precisely the way we wanted to and created some constraints. Now, Dallas provided a great opportunity for us. The opportunity was this. The other problem in using AVL to know where the police are is that AVL is often implemented in a staged way. In other words, we buy a new car and we put AVL in it, and the old cars don't have any AVL. So the nice part about Dallas was by 2010, every element, as they call it, I don't know why the term element is used, but every element in the department had AVL. Right? So in other words, every police car. By the way, I should note, that means every patrol car, every detective car, etc. So every police car has AVL, and that's one of the reasons we chose to work in Dallas. The other reason was the chief was very open to the idea of experimentation. And I think in the U.S. at least, and it looks like it's happening here, the openness of police to experimentation is growing over time. When Larry and I did our experiment with Chief Boza in Minneapolis in 1991, I think, getting a police chief to do an experiment was really an unusual affair, and you needed someone who was as interesting, exciting, and intellectually committed as Tony Boza. And a little bit later, I'll tell you a story of one of my first meetings with him about that sort of idea of being willing to say things that other people don't say. But anyway, And that where I lost my idea. But anyway, the idea of doing more experiments has become something that I'm finding lots of police departments are willing. And I think this is a good indication more generally. But a chief of Dallas was willing. We had all the cars equipped with AVL. So here's the experiment we developed. It was conducted for 13 weeks. Why 13 weeks? Because this was a terrible imposition in some sense in the department. We had all agreed that running this too long would be very difficult. We thought that the kind of impacts we were looking for would occur relatively quickly. So we had an agreement for a relatively short time span. I think it's a good lesson. Not every experiment has to be run for 6 months or a year. There are certain types of effects you might expect to occur very quickly. As I noted before, it was conducted at two levels. The beat level, which was the level that patrol allocations were made in Dallas, there are 236 beats. I should note, Dallas, in terms of square kilometers, is about 1,000 square kilometers. So these beats are not like one block long. Indeed, there are some, I measured yesterday, there was one beat like 3 miles long or something. Where I come from, that would be the entire city. Dallas is in Texas, you know, everything is big in Texas kind of thing. It's by the way, one of the, I think it's the largest city in Texas. In Karen, what?
Geographic,
not, is it Dallas?
Houston.
Okay.
Dallas is more land.
Anyway, so these are not hot spots. These are sort of areas, if you like. They're not New York City precincts, but they're still fairly large. We also ran the experiment at the level of directed patrol hotspots. At each CompStat meeting, division commanders, and I'll tell you more about this in a minute, were asked to identify a maximum of 5 hotspots, including 1 or 2 streets. This creates some problems for our study, as I'll tell you a bit later. And we included those hotspots in the experiment. So here is the treatment. The commanders were asked to specify each week during the experiment the amount of patrol they wanted for each beat. And everybody was asked this. It was related to the experimental beats and the control beats. How much patrol do you want? Each week in the experimental beats only, the commanders were given a form which listed the amount of patrol that was actually delivered each beat the prior week. In other words, so you knew how much you'd asked for, you knew how much you got, okay? And the hope was here that if commanders had an idea of what they were actually getting, right, that they would, it would help them in terms of management. That if they saw that they weren't getting what they expected, they might ask for more, or they might tell people, you know, that it's, I want to see you really get this done, etc. I noted already the human subjects problem and also the union problems. So what we have here, and it's very important, is we only have the total number of hours each week. In other words, we're not telling you car 6 was in the beat 4 hours, car 4 was there 3 hours, etc. We're telling you in beat 110 there was 10 hours overall of patrol over the last week. So that's the information they had. Certainly, if you were a commander, it seems to me, you would want more detailed information, but that was just not possible. And this is more information than anyone has ever had before. For the control beats, as I noted, they filled out the forms of what they wanted, but they got no feedback about the actual level of patrol. So here's an example of a form. I don't know if you can see anything up there. I can't, it's hard for me to see here, but it just, each week they get the beat number, they get the total number of hours they allocated, they get the actual call hours that they got. It was divided into discretionary time and total actual. In other words, they didn't know how much time they're on call or something like this, and how much time they were just hanging around, if you like. And then they'd be asked to tell us how much more they wanted, how much less they wanted, etc. Now, there's another aspect of this experiment, which I think is important, is in Dallas, the beats vary. Those over 200 beats vary greatly in terms of the amount of crime. And we thought this whole system would be different, if you like, or might have a different effect in the places where there was a lot of crime activity and places where there's not as much crime activity. And we wanted to take that into account at the beginning. So we used an approach, it's called the block randomized experiment, in which we first divided up the the beats into crime levels, and then we randomly allocated them in crime levels. What this does, by the way, it's important to think about, randomization doesn't promise that everything's going to be equivalent. It promises that there's no reason to think things are inequivalent. But you can maximize equivalence. You can try to create greater equivalence through this process of blocking. And it was an interesting exercise anyway. We found, we identified using an approach called trajectory analysis that there were four sort of crime levels in these different beats. One was a very low crime group. There were 21 beats. A low crime group of 94 beats, a medium crime group of 100 beats, and a very high crime group of that were 17 beats. And then we randomized within each of those groups so we had an equal number, if you like, of very high crime beats in the treatment group and in the control group. There's the trajectory analysis. One of the things that surprises me every time I look at it is there isn't much seasonality. But nonetheless, what you can see here is the groups divide pretty well across these overall crime, and the high crime group is five times as high as the low crime group on average. What about the treatment for the hotspots? Well, what we did was they had CompStat meetings at the division level. There were seven divisions. At those CompStat meetings, they were asked to identify five priority hotspots for inclusion in the study within each watch. Now, many times, and here's the problem for us, in a question I'm going to come to at the end, many times they might identify more than five hotspots. You know, they might have 10 hotspots in that division, or 20, and this is per watch, so the three watches a day. So what we're doing, though, is just we say, give us five, we'll track five. The reason we did that was in negotiations with the commanders, they said, we can't fill out all the paperwork it's going to take for you guys for these five hotspots and track this, etc. So we agreed. In the end, I kind of regret this, as I'll come to towards the end, but it was reasonable for the basic question, and we just wanted to see whether you could bring more control to hotspots using the system. And then once they'd identify these five hotspots, they would say how much patrol they wanted. This week, I want to see you guys there 3 hours overall, or 10 hours overall, whatever it was. And we kept track of that. And again, the control and the treatment hotspots, in this case, a treatment hotspot was a hotspot within a treatment beat. A control hotspot was a hotspot within a control beat. In the control hotspots, they didn't get any feedback. By the way, you should note, it would be the same commanders quite often, right? Because they get a feedback they'd have in their division. They might have five hotspots this week in watch one, and three of them would be in control and two of them in treatment. On the next week, they get back feedback on the treatment ones, but not on the control ones. This is the feedback form for the hotspots. And as you can see, it has the intersection, the place, the type of attention, which was generally directed patrol, how much time they wanted. And in these forms, they asked us to put in also the crime for that hotspot the week before and during that week, etc., because these guys want to be intelligent, if you like, about what they're doing. And by the way, the control group also got the crime numbers. Okay, so there's the experiment, an experimental level of beats, an experimental level of hotspots. And here are the key questions. Does knowledge about police patrol time influence the time that police managers expect patrol cars to spend in patrol beats under their supervision? And by the way, I'm going to start off with the data about the patrol beats. And the second is, does knowledge about actual police patrol influence the amount of patrol delivered in a beat area? The third is, does knowledge about actual police patrol lead to crime reductions in the experimental beats? The idea here is, I didn't really expect at the outset that it would affect expectations very much. In other words, it seemed to me that you wanted in your beat, depending on how much crime you had, for example, a certain level of patrol. We wondered whether it would affect the amount of patrol you got in your beats. And if it would affect the amount of patrol you got in your beats, we thought it might have an impact on crime. So here's the results. The first is, does this knowledge affect the amount of police presence you expect in beats? And surprisingly to me, it did. As you can see, consistently through the 13 weeks of the experiment, the treatment group expected more time, right? We'll talk about this a little later, but So the experiment has an effect on your expectations. The treatment group commanders want more patrol. And it's statistically significant. I should know highly statistically significant. But it has no significant effect on how much patrol you actually got. Now, overall, the treatment seems to be a little above this, but that's an exaggeration, because if you look over here in the statistical analysis, you can see that assignment, which is over here, which is treatment versus control, where is it? Correct my intercept trajectory, assignment is very small, tiny F statistic. In other words, there's very, very, it's not just not significant, it's a very, very small impact. So, big significant, if you like, effect on how much you expect, but no effect on what you actually get. And not surprisingly, since there was there wasn't more patrol in the experimental beats, you did not get an effect in crime. So, on the one hand, you could say, this is not very good news. Somebody asked the question about what about experiments that come out with news that's not good, right? You're not getting a benefit, it doesn't seem, at the beat level if you have information, at least this type of information, about where the cops are. However, I think it's not inconsistent with what we've learned over the last 20 years, which is large-scale general applications of police resources don't necessarily have an impact in crime. You have to be very focused. And, of course, that leads us to the issue of focus. What about the hotspots? Same three questions. Does knowledge about actual police patrol influence the time that police managers expect patrol cars to spend in directed patrol areas in their beats? Does knowledge about actual police patrol influence the amount of actual patrol delivered in hotspot areas? And finally, if it does that influence the amount of crime at those hotspots? Now, in this case, I'm not going to show you weekly totals because, remember, the way we designed this experiment is a lot of imbalance week to week, because each week in a division, in a watch, they choose hotspot. So what we're doing here is looking at every week, in a sense, as one unit in a sample, every week, every hotspot week. If you chose hotspot this week, what happened that week? That's one unit in our sample. So the weekly idea would not be, I think, relevant to discuss. But if you look here, the first question is, well, does it affect your expectations? It affected expectations at the beat level, but no, it doesn't seem to affect expectations at the hotspot level. Indeed, the control hotspots on average seem to have slightly more, although it's not at all statistically significant, slightly higher expectations of patrol. So at the beat level, you want more patrol. At the hotspot level, it's not any difference. Well, does the knowledge about actual police patrol influence the amount of actual patrol? Well, it does, it turns out, in this case, and it's significant. There's about a 20% increase in the amount of patrol in the treatment hotspots as opposed to the control hotspots. And it's statistically significant. So you don't expect more, but you, in fact, are able to get more. Well, that's good news. And it turns out that you get more police patrol, but you also get what seems to be a significant reduction in crime. In the, again, about 20% in the treatment hotspots, crime is lower than in the control hotspots. So the story seems to be two very different stories, right? On the one hand, we have the beat level. Raises expectations, but you don't actually get anything out of it. No effect on crime. Hotspot level doesn't raise expectations, right? But you do get something out of it. You do better at bringing more time to these hotspots, and you get a significant reduction in crime. So it kind of raises questions, what's really going on? Okay, so why did AVL increase expectations at the beat level, but not actual patrol? We think, and this is a case of the black box that we don't know, but we think that the new system gave an illusion to the commanders. They were able to control allocation of patrol time at a micro, at a macro level. This shouldn't be micro; it should be macro level. So, in other words, each week they get these statistics from us, and remember, part of those statistics was how much free time they had, and it looks like they have a lot of free time. And I suspect what occurs here is that they say, wait a minute, these guys have free time, let's utilize that free time. I want you to be in beat X more time. But reality is that they don't actually control the time of their officers. The real control in a place like Dallas, I think, comes from the dispatchers. And this is particularly a problem in a place like Dallas. It's a very large geography, right? You're covering a very large geography. What often happens is that there'll be no element or no police car in way out here in Dallas, and they will call whoever has free time and bring them over. Well, when they're called over, now all of a sudden they're on call, but when they finish the call, they close it, and now all of a sudden they have, quote, discretionary time. We're trying to look at this more carefully, but it seems to us that, at least in cities like Dallas, the idea that they have lots and lots of discretionary time is not quite right, because cross-beat dispatch, large areas, other sort of things that police are doing means that time is much more constrained, and the commanders don't have a lot of control over it. So at least in a large geography like Dallas, ABL at the beat level may create illusions of control, if you like, among commanders, but not actually increase their control. So why did treatment affect actual patrol at the hotspots but not desired patrol levels? It seems to me, first of all, that the allocation of time to hotspots is a lot more concrete. One of the problems with generalized strategies across large areas is that it's hard to really get a handle of it. I mean, is 1 half hour going to make a difference? Is 10 minutes? You're spreading people across a whole beat, etc. And these beats are fairly large areas. But at the same time, when you're dealing with a hotspot, police commanders, I'm sure you do, you say, you know what, look at the kind of problem we have, look at the amount of problem. I want you to be there at night, a few hours, 2 or 3 hours each night for next week. And whether I give you data on how much time they actually spent there or not, it's not going to change your expectations. Your expectations are fairly fixed because you're dealing with a very specific and bounded problem. It seems to me as the problem gets unspecific and unbounded, it becomes much more difficult. Now, what about the fact they actually could get the guys there? It seems to me it's part of the same story. It's one thing to tell guys to hang out an entire beat and to increase the number of hours. It's another thing to say to your patrol cops who are riding around those areas, listen, when you have some extra time, go to 13th and Lytton Avenue, right? Spend some time there. All of a sudden, you have a very specific request. People have a very specific place to go to, etc. I think that it enables, let's call it, the cops to follow through in a way they couldn't at the beat level. Now, why on crime hotspots? Why is there an effect? Well, I don't think this is surprising news. There's now a large research literature in this group. I don't think I need to tell about it. I suspect this is taught in your courses that shows that hotspots can have crime prevention benefits. Larry Sherman and I did the first study with Tony Boza. That was published in 1995, but now there are 25 tests of this, 21 showing statistically significant crime prevention benefits. All of the randomized experiments, which are the strongest designs, show crime prevention benefits. So the idea that if we increase the amount of patrol at hotspots, you get a significant effect at those hotspots, I don't think is a radical idea, but fits the story I just told. Now, when I first discussed this with my good friend and colleague, Larry Sherman, he said to me, I call it the elephant in the closet. Larry, of course, was not thinking about what I did and its specific implications for organizational questions in policing. I think there are direct implications here about the use of ABL. He was thinking also about a sort of problematic issue in the story I just told. Okay, our study is clear about ABL. It's useful at the hotspot level, or not useful at the beat level, at least with the kind of information we were able to provide. However, and here's the elephant in the closet, if the hotspots patrol was effective, why don't we see an improvement in the treatment beats overall? Right? I mean, there's a kind of problem. So there are a group of explanations that you could have. One is, does this mean that hotspots policing is just displacing crime from place to place? Well, I think that this runs counter to most of the evidence we have, which is that there's only one study I know of on police patrol that suggests that hotspots produces displacement. And that study shows that the overall crime prevention benefit is more than the displacement. So the evidence doesn't seem to support the displacement idea, but nonetheless, it could be one possible explanation. Or it could be simply that the effects of the hotspots patrol are being washed out. That's important too, by the way, because it suggests that if you're looking for overall crime prevention gains, the question becomes, will I get those? Maybe I have an effect in this area, but by the time I look at this particular place, by the time I look at the whole area, it gets washed out because the whole area has thousands and thousands of crime. Still an important issue. Okay, so I'll start out by saying that this study is not an ideal one to look at this problem. Okay, so I've given you a randomized experiment that gives you a very clear causal answer. The great part of experiments is the results, when they're unambiguous, are unambiguous. They tell a story that is believable because of the design. The story I'm about to tell is not like that. Okay? The story I'm about to tell is exploratory, because it's a question raised that wasn't a purpose in our study, but it's still an important question. All right? When Larry and I did the Minneapolis hotspots experiment, we had a paragraph in there in which we said, this study does not examine the issue of displacement. Because first we want to be able to show that if you bring a hotspots patrol to hotspots, these intensive patrols, you will get a crime prevention benefits in those places. We said it's up to the next group of people to figure out that next question. What I'm going to say now is, now that we've done the study of ADL, the first study of its type, it gives us important information. There's other questions you could begin answering that I think are very important and might design a study a bit differently. But I'm going to give you a taste anyway of what I think you're going to find and some guidance if one of you in your master's course decides to do one of these great experiments that Larry's been running across the UK. Okay, so here are the problems, remember? We don't have all the hotspots. We only have a sample of 5 hotspots per division per watch. So there is a problematic sample to begin with. We can't gouge the overall amount of crime that hotspots patrol reduced. We can simply say that in the hotspots we looked at, crime went down. What I really want to know is all the hotspots, what happened, how much crime was reduced, etc. But nonetheless, I think we can raise some issues about what's going on, especially about this issue of the washing out effect. So what I don't have in this table, I'll tell you what I do, and then I'll tell you what I don't have, I noticed last night. What I have in this table is I have the number of beats per trajectory group, low, medium, high, very high. And now I'm very glad I did this trajectory group analysis because I wouldn't have been able to do this if I hadn't. As I said at the beginning, the very high trajectory has only 17 beats. If you look at the number of hotspots per beat, in the low group there are only 2. Which probably means that we probably have most of them or all of them. We don't know that. But they're much fewer than one would expect given the parameters we gave them. And it moves higher up as you move to the medium and high. But the what's very interesting is the very high have a lot more than anybody else, even about 20% more or 30% more than the high group. Now, what's even more interesting, and I didn't put in the table, is that if you look at the amount of crime in these hotspots, the very high group has twice as much crime as the high group in terms of the crimes going on at the hotspots. So in the very high group, you have very hot spots and probably representing a lot of them if we were able to, if we had more beats of this sort. So these are the very hot beats, very hot spots. And here's something interesting. So we don't find, as I noted earlier, an overall effect across all the groups. So if you divide it by trajectory, you can see that if you look at the mean crime in beats, for the low beats, it's 71 versus 70, 103 versus 101, 145 versus 148. So for those areas, the explanation we would have is either displacement is going on, or you're just washing it out. In other words, there's not enough hotspots. The washout effect for the low group, for example, is extremely reasonable. There's very few hotspots and they're not very hot. But look at the high group, the very high group. In this case, you've got a difference of about 30 crimes per beat. Okay? And that actually is quite meaningful, I think, in this context over 13 weeks, type 1 and type 2 crimes. So in that group, you see some impact. Now, this is very exploratory. This is called mining your data, looking through it. It's not okay to make a concentrated statement, but it is okay, in my view, to make a hypothesis. So here's my hypothesis. Someone should test it. Maybe I'll test it. Which is that you are going to see larger area impacts when you're dealing with very high crime areas, very high crime hotspots. Right? Very high crime areas with a lot of hotspots, because a high crime area will not be an area, as we all know, in which crime is spread throughout. There'll be specific nodes in that area. So you'll have a lot of these hotspots, relatively concentrated small areas. They will have very high rates of crime. That is where you're going to be able to detect an effect. So I wouldn't run an experiment in a low-crime town with very few hotspots. I would run it in a very, very high-activity area like London, etc., where you can observe. So the elephant in the closet story, we don't know the answer to, but one answer to it is it looks like there may be washing out in many areas where crime is not serious and hotspots are not serious, but that you may be able to see an effect. The effect does show up if you look at the very hot areas and look at those very hot spots, which have the highest number and the hottest hot spots. But let me return after that digression to the study again, limitations, and say something, go back to what we could say something about. First of all, every study has limitations. It's not an embarrassment to talk about limitations. It just tells people in the audience to remember that, you know, not under every circumstance and every situation do the findings we've had work. There was a short study period, purposefully. Would some of this decay in very long periods of time? If you looked at the charts at the very beginning, you can see there was some decay in the differences in the levels of patrol. It was not used as a supervisory mechanism for individual officers, right? We only knew how many elements, how much time. We couldn't tell you whether so-and-so was doing his job, etc. That might work better. That wouldn't work in many American cities. And we did not have information on all the hotspots within the beats, which, as we've talked about, creates a problem looking at the issue of the elephant in the closet. But we did learn, I think, very important. It's the first randomized study. I'm very pleased the Police Foundation in Dallas participated to look at this issue of will knowledge about AVL help police commanders in allocating patrol? Will it have an effect on crime? It doesn't appear very useful from our study in allocating patrol in large geographic areas. It's very consistent with research we've been doing over the last 20 years. Focus in, go with those very specific places. It doesn't seem to help in larger areas. It may be useful in allocating directed patrol at crime hotspots. I mean, maybe a little bit too academic. It is useful in allocating directed patrol at crime hotspots. You can, it seems, increase your effectiveness in getting the cops there, even if you don't know who the individual officers are, by knowledge about whether they're going there when you ask them to go there. And when you get that benefit, it leads to crime prevention benefits at the specific hotspots. And based on the literature we know about hotspots, the hypothesis that you're having an overall crime prevention benefit is actually stronger than the one that it's displacing and you're not. But anyway, thank you very much. I hope you've enjoyed this little discussion or story about AVL technologies.